thought you decided you were in no hope and defected.
Right, shall we start?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my name's Roger Liddell, and I'm pleased to be here today to chair this discussion. I currently work for Peter Mandelson, and before that I slaved away in 10 Downing Street for 7.5 years for the Prime Minister as his European advisor. Now, I hope we're going to have a good Marx-style discussion in the coming hour. That is a debate that's open and where everything all hangs out, that's stimulating and there's lots of lateral thinking, that's unconventional and good fun. And that would be a very Marx-type debate. The way we're going to do it is that Mark is going to spend 10 minutes summarising his basic thesis, and then Philip is going to give us another 10 minutes on what a non-European view of that thesis is, and then Charles Powell is going to give us another 10 minutes building not only on his extensive experience of British attitudes towards Europe, but also the enormous fund of knowledge he's developed about Asia in the last decade and a half. So that's what we're going to do. 10 minutes from each of our speakers, then discussion, and finish at 2. Mark.
Thank you very much, Roger. I'm going to start a few weeks ago when George Bush made his first trip abroad after he was elected as president. And it was very interesting that he chose on that trip not to go to Beijing or to Delhi or to many of the other places that are said to be the global powers of the 21st century, but to Brussels. And many people have talked about it and thought about why he chose to do that. And I think that it was quite an interesting illustration of some of the lessons that we've learned over the last couple of years. Because for all the talk of American empire, in many ways the last 2 years have been a very vivid demonstration of the limits of American power. It's quite clear that America is an incredibly powerful country, but its dominance is only really clear-cut on two levels. First of all, the ability to fight and win very intensive conventional wars. And secondly, the ubiquity of American popular culture. And Joe Nye has characterized these two kinds of power as hard and soft power. And what's been interesting about the last couple of years is both hard power, the ability to get your way by coercion, and soft power through attraction, have been declining currencies for the US, both because terrorism and weapons of mass destruction are ways that weak countries or even groups of individuals can try and neutralize a superpower's military machine, but also because the more the US administration has resorted to employing hard power to pursue its political objectives, the greater the damage has been to its soft power and its ability to achieve things through persuasion. And what was interesting about this visit was it was the first visit, I think, in 50 years' time when it wasn't a gaggle of Europeans going to Washington with their tails between their legs, unable to sort out problems in their own continent, desperately pleading with the superpower to come to their aid. Instead, there was a very long list of issues which President Bush had where he wanted European help, and that list is probably the first time in my lifetime that list has been longer than the list of issues that Europeans wanted American help on. And it was a realization that without European diplomacy, without European money, without European soft power, Freedom's March would be a lot more halting in places like Kiev, Sarajevo, Ankara, Ramallah, and even in Tehran. And I would argue that was for five key reasons, which is the core of the book. The first five key reasons which are actually changing the shape of political power, and there are areas where Europe is in the vanguard. And the first is this fact that it is a new kind of power, which I call transformative power, and it's easy to miss. It's so easy to miss that it's usually confused with weakness, because it's not based on a European dream or a bold vision of the future. Instead, Europe's power is driven by a desire to evade from the past. Paul Valéry, the French poet, after World War One, said, "We hope vaguely, we dread precisely." And I think that's a very clear summary of what the European project's about. In many ways, European integration has worked like an invisible hand through coming up with concrete agreements on issues like coal and steel and trade, and has not displaced traditional political structures. The British House of Commons, British law courts, British civil servants are still there. But now they're all agents of the European Union. The laws that they implement have been agreed by British politicians, but they are European. And the same's true when the European Union employs military force. When European soldiers go abroad, they usually travel under a United Nations or NATO flag rather than the European banner. And the net result of this is that whilst every American company, embassy, or military base is a potential terrorist target around the world, the fact that the European Union is much less visible, much more difficult to glimpse, means that when it spreads its influence, it does it without arising the same amount of provocation that the American model of power does. Second feature of the European Union is that it's not a state. It doesn't have a single phone number. Europe is a network of many centres of power that are united by common policies, common goals, and common laws. And what this allows the European Union to do is to expand, to have ever greater numbers of people, to create an ever bigger market, bigger ways of doing things, but without asking any of these countries to give up on their independence. And that is one of the reasons why people agree to the European Union internally, that they manage to keep control over decisions about tax and spend and education and health and the things that they really care about. But even more important than the impact internally is the effect that that's had on the world stage, because Europe has actually managed to grow to be a real superpower in many areas, but without causing the countries around it to organise against it. In fact, the more powerful Europe becomes, the more powerful a magnet it becomes for its neighbours. And if you look back in historical terms, and Philip Bobbitt's much better placed to do this than I am, every single historical example, whether it was Spain or France or Britain or the Soviet Union or even the US in the 21st century, as they've grown in power, they have caused neighbours to unite against it. And the European Union has managed to grow, but countries don't want to balance it. They want to join it. And I argue that the reason that has taken place is the third point I want to make, which is that the EU doesn't change or other countries or project itself by threatening to invade people. The most amazing thing about the European Union is that the worst thing it can do to countries that are outside it is nothing at all. Its biggest threat is withdrawing the hand of friendship, and particularly the prospect of membership. And for countries like Bosnia, Turkey, the Ukraine, the only thing that's worse than having a group of bureaucrats from Brussels descending on them, telling them how to reform their legal, judicial, political systems, is to hear that they're not going to be coming at all. And there's a sort of remarkable difference in the way that the EU and the US have dealt with their neighbours. The threats are very similar. Drug trafficking, large flows of migrants, networks of international criminals and terrorists. But the responses couldn't be more different. While the US has sent troops into neighbouring countries more than 15 times over the last 50 years, many of these countries have barely changed at all. Countries like Haiti or Colombia have limped from crisis to crisis, often sucking US troops back in again when things go wrong again. I'm not a pacifist. I recognise that military force is sometimes not only the right thing to do, but it's the only way of solving problems. In the Balkans in the 1990s, we saw how much we needed military intervention, and it was the US that led the NATO airstrikes to protect the Muslim population while Europe fretted. But I think even in the Balkans, Europeans have learned the hard way that whilst we needed military power to stop the genocide, it is the prospect of deep political and economic engagement and possibility of eventually joining the European club that is actually driving political and social transformation on the ground in countries like Croatia, Macedonia and Bosnia. The fourth point I want to make is how does Europe do it? And that's really, I think, one of the most fundamental points, which is that Europe has a secret weapon, which is called the law. Many people have focused on Europe's obsession with the law as a sign of weakness, but in many ways, I think it's the key to its power. because it allows you to do more than simply scrape the surface. Military power can be spectacularly transformative in the short term. No one could look at Afghanistan and Iraq and not see the effect that military power can have. But if you want to change countries for good, it's not just about changing the regime. It's about changing the way that they're run. And if you look at Poland, for instance, or the Czech Republic, it's not just the regime that's been changed by the European Union. It's everything from its economic policies, its property laws, its treatment of minorities. And that's because every country that joins the European Union has to absorb over 80,000 pages of new laws which govern everything from gay rights to food safety. And once countries are drawn into this Eurosphere and have adopted this legislation, they're changed forever. They never want to get out. And it means that whilst military power can be very effective when you're concentrating on that country and have got an enormous and you've got troops on the ground, once your back is turned, your potency immediately starts to wane. Whereas if your power is entrenched in international law and multilateral institutions, those trenches are, the changes are entrenched, and your transformative power will last. And that's really the fifth and final point I want to make, which is that the argument I'm making in the book is maybe even bolder than the title, the already too bold title seems to imply, which is that European power is not simply a question of an argument that Europe is going to do well over the next few years, and a sort of seesaw argument where we see a Chinese century and a Japanese century and an American century. I'm arguing that actually the rise of European power is a paradigm-shifting event, and which will actually change the rules of the world for the next century. And many people will dismiss what I've just said so far by arguing that I'm just talking about enlargement, that it's a regional phenomenon, that Europe has had very little impact beyond its borders. And I'd say that there are two answers to that. The first is that even if it were just a regional phenomenon, Europe's region is vast, because beyond the 450 million citizens that are already living in the European Union, there are another 1.5 billion people living in 80 countries who are umbilically linked to the European Union, because we're their biggest partner for trade, for finance, for foreign investment, and for aid. And every single country that Europe has entered into an agreement with there are conditions attached to our relationship with them about human rights, crime and border control and all sorts of other things. And what's happening gradually is that these 2 billion people, which I call the Eurosphere, in Europe's growing zone of influence, are being transformed to adopt European norms through their deep engagement with the European Union. But even more important than that is the fact that the European model is already spreading like a virus. There are countries all over the world that are drawing inspiration from the European model and creating their own neighbourhood clubs, whether it's ASEAN or Mercosur or the African Union or the Arab League. And most dramatically for me has been watching how the Chinese have both embraced multilateral institutions on a global level, but also looked at how they can use the European experience to build an East Asian community in their own neighbourhood, which will eventually, in the long term, in their thinking, allow them to deal with some of the corrosive mistrust of China that their neighbours have, and maybe one day persuade them that that a vast American military presence in the area is not necessary. And what seems to be happening is something which is really quite dramatic. I think 500 years ago, Europeans invented the most effective form of political organisation in history, the nation state. And at that time, over the last 500 years, countries have been faced with a very stark choice, either to become a nation state themselves or to get taken over by one. And 50 years ago, Europeans went back and reinvented this model. And I argue in the book that by the end of this century, countries will face an equally stark choice, either to join the European Union or to develop their own regional club based on the same principles of peace, mutual interference, and the rule of law. And that regional domino effect will start to completely redefine the meaning of power. And while that process unfolds, I think that the 21st century will come to be seen as a new European century, not because the European Union is going to be running the world like an empire, but because the European way of doing things will have become the world's.
Well, Mark, thank you. That was 12 minutes, not 10, but that's not bad for an author. Philip Bobbitt.
May I use the...
Of course.
I always feel I can make a quicker exit if I'm standing. This is a wonderful book, fascinating, provocative, interesting, and insofar as my role here is to introduce it to you, let me just say, go out and buy it. I enjoyed reading it, and I'll just discuss really two aspects of it today. I was struck when Mark Leonard quoted Paul Valéry, and I thought of a phrase of Valéry's that reminds me a bit of Marx's attitude towards the transformative power of the European Union. Valéry said, "The universe is but a flaw in the endless perfection of non-being." And if you think that the role of law, both constitutional law that has organized the European Union and international law, is what has led to the transformative power of the European Union, then you are living in a world of non-being in which the universe is just a minor flaw. It's not law, at least it's not law alone, but it is the connection between law and strategy that has made the European constitutional experiment so exciting, so fascinating, and I think so compelling to many other states. So my first point is that whereas Mark Leonard writes, and I quote, "What was it that transformed Europe from being an incubator for world wars into a transmission belt for peace and democracy? The simple answer is international law." That is too simple an answer. Without the extended deterrence of the post-war period, without the strategic stalemate over Central Europe, I don't think there would be a European Union. And I don't think if we look to the future and neglect the strategic elements that must be a partner with international law, that we will see phenomena like the network states of Europe replicated in other parts of the world. And that's my second point, on which I'll speak at much greater length, namely that network states like the European Union are the constitutional future, but they won't come just in one model. Umbrella states like the European Union that have a common single market and also at some point a defense and foreign policy, but allow for considerable constitutional differentiation between them, even to cultural units much smaller than Scotland and Wales or Catalonia or the Basque region, even down to cities. These phenomena I don't think will be sort of one size fits all. They'll be networked, they'll be devolved, they will outsource, they'll be deregulated. I call them market states for that reason. But they won't follow a single sustainable model to success. I will describe for you three very broad approaches. I'll call them entrepreneurial, managerial, and mercantile. These are really sort of cartoons, but you'll get the idea that each of them is a network state of the kind described here, or a market state in my terms, and yet has substantial variation from the others. When the interconnected freedom of a global elite and the United States, a superpower, lead the world towards greater economic integration and towards greater economic prosperity as a whole, then I think we'll move towards an entrepreneurial market model. Cities and other sources of power will diminish the influence of national governments. Entrepreneurial states are not run by businesses, but they are run like businesses, and they focus on efficiency and on individual freedom of choice. They try to maximize choice. More and more aspects of individual life are run as though they were businesses through outsourcing, taking care of our children, running government services like prisons, security systems, pensions, increasing support for NGOs, particularly the media, Growing inequality is tolerated as long as people see opportunity growing to improve their lives. This is a world of large and powerful interconnected megacities. There's a great deal of mobility. Elites move to points of the greatest synergy, greatest opportunity, and poor people are eager to move also towards these magnets of opportunity. The entrepreneurial market state is committed to the belief that the growing income gaps will narrow development gaps. National governments exist to provide infrastructure, education, intangible infrastructure, as well as tangible, intellectual, and real property rules, but they don't try to achieve the nationalizing welfare roles of the 20th century nation states. Power is diffused to non-state institutions, corporations, I mentioned the media. Deregulation encompasses not only industries, but also women's reproduction, family configurations, immigration, and culture. In the entrepreneurial state, rather than neat, self-contained national markets and nation states, with authority unambiguously assigned within democratic and geographic boundaries, there is instead a mesh of multiple loyalties, even multiple citizenships. Now, that's one approach. It's closely identified in a sort of a caricatured way with the United States. A second sort of network state I would call a managerial state. It questions the idea of a monochromatic world of global integration. It focuses instead on the persisting power of culture and of history. In a world of managerial states, the driver is not the United States, with its force for commonality and universality, but rather the interplay among our differences, and it is exemplified today, I think, by the European Union. It's a world of regional umbrellas, states that differentiate themselves by their history, forming great trading and defense blocs that try to maximize local autonomy for different nationalities, ethnic groups, religions, language groups, even different geophysical topographies. Those commentators who saw no alternative to the U.S. as a future model greatly underestimated the power of identity. And by national identity, I mean the cultural, linguistic, historical sense of a national group, not the simply status idea. The same globalizing pressures that pushed us towards the entrepreneurial state could push us just as easily towards a managerial state because they threaten the cultural heritage and sense of community. In such a state, people don't trust the rising tide brought by liberalization of trade and finance. They harbor anxieties over greater inequalities and a kind of relentless globalization placed in unaccountable hands. But they don't simply reject the multinational or multicultural groupings. They try and restructure them. They try and take a somewhat longer and more communitarian view of how they can be harnessed. It's a world that has not rejected an emphasis on efficiency and functionality, but it has rejected homogeneity in favor of multiple modernities. That's a kind of, I've called it, managerial market state. The dark side of such a state is its potential for regional and large-scale conflict. A third possible world comes into being when market states become autarkic. I call this the approach of the mercantile state. In such a state, the increased connections of our current period have grown into contagions. Terrorism, drugs, ethnic violence, illegal migration, environmental degradation, arms trafficking, human trafficking, the global spread of diseases infecting both animals and human beings, and also the contagion of financial vulnerability. The more closely integrated economies become, the more likely it is that movements in the economies of other currencies or other health systems will infect one another. States manifesting a mercantile approach have reacted to these negative developments with alarm. Once again, the driver is the United States, but now in a negative direction. The lack of personal safety in America, its reliance on vast prison numbers and capital punishment, its pollution, the ubiquity of weapons among its populace, the various addictions of its population. I've given up martinis for Lent, but I'm looking forward to Easter. All of these suggest that an unregulated domestic environment is satisfactory only for those rich enough to insulate themselves from it. What the U.S. needs, this world concludes, is not more growth and efficiency, but more humane, more stable, and more subtle institutions. In the mercantile world, states have experienced the greatest volatility, the economic peaks and valleys, bubbles and currency runs that accompany economic integration. Led by authoritarian societies like Malaysia and China, they oppose the transparency and free capital flows demanded by the U.S. Indeed, these states react with some anger that only the U.S. or U.S.-led multilateral institutions had the resources to bail out countries that have been caught in such speculatively driven monetary crises. Corruption is worse in this world, and it is the least transparent of all the market state societies. Now, it might look from the sort of brief sketch I've given you as though these could be typecast. The U.S. is an entrepreneurial state. It does sort of look like that now. The Europeans fit more a managerial model, and perhaps some of the Asian states a mercantile model. Japan comes to mind, China. I mentioned Malaysia, Singapore. But these models are not stable. They can change over time as societies move from one model to another, trying to maximize the use of a constitutional form in the service of their values. Because there is no perfect model and no perfect society, they're unstable. And this often brings about conflict. So my two points are, first of all, even in the Elysian Europe, you cannot separate law from strategy. It is unrealistic, and it is ultimately self-defeating. The greatest power for the European Union, I'm afraid to say, was not Jean Monnet, who I greatly admire and revere, but it was probably the nuclear deterrent that kept Europe safe and kept Germany from going nuclear itself. And my second point is that there isn't just one model. Europe will not run the 21st century. But the United States won't run the 21st century either, and I certainly wouldn't want it to. The 21st century is not going to be run. That's the point of a network state. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Philip Bollock. Now, Charles Pole.
Well, thank you very much. I'm here to put the view that China, rather than Europe or America, is more likely to run the 21st century. I'm going to put that view sitting down. I arrived from a week in Asia at 6 o'clock this morning and have spent the hours since then chairing the China-Britain Business Council. If I stand up, I should probably fall over. But at least having come fresh from doing a week's business in Asia, I think I can say I'm going to put my mouth where my money is. Let me just comment for a few brief moments on both Mark's and Philip Bobbitt's presentations. First of all, Mark starts by saying, well, it's so significant President Bush came to Europe. He didn't go to Russia or China. Well, of course he came to ruddy Europe. I mean, America's relations with Europe are far worse than they are with Russia or China. He had to come here and start to get them sorted out. Now, I'm not one who denies that Europe has not achieved a very great deal. It has. Peace between its members, its enlargement has been a huge step forward. Regional aid to poorer parts of Europe has been a great act of solidarity. The internal market in goods is a huge advantage, and so is Europe's record of aid to the Third World. But basically, Europe's achievements have been about cleaning up the mess which Europe made of the last century, not setting itself as a sort of guide for the next century. Why don't I think Europe's going to be a guide? I'll tell you. First, because it's quite unable to live up to the standards which it sets itself. What's happened to the Lisbon agenda? That was going to introduce the free market thinking into Europe, do the things in mainland Europe that Margaret Thatcher did here. Well, it seems to have disappeared. I mean, Europe seems to me to be very much more concerned with stopping what it calls social dumping. All that means is social dumping is actually allowing countries in Eastern Europe and elsewhere to make use of their comparative advantage. It's more concerned to stop a single market in services, even though that would be the single biggest step it could now take to create more jobs. And it's more concerned to preserve subsidies for agriculture than it is to allow the Third World to trade freely with Europe. And I think all that, for me, is a backward-looking agenda rather than a forward-looking agenda. And I think that will not make it a very desirable model. I would also say that there's another serious problem, and that is the lack of enthusiasm in Europe for the European model. I think people see the institutions as pretty remote. I don't think the European Constitution has helped at all. It's couched in language which is completely unreadable in any language. I've tried it in three, and I've got a fourth to come, and I still can't make head or tail of it. So it's a pretty tepid Europe. I know Mark invented Cool Britannia, but he's now come up with tepid Europe, and I don't see that as a very, very convincing model. So my contention would be that Europe really lacks a mission. It just wants to be comfortable, cocooned within its own neighbourhood. It wants to pay Danegeld to keep the teeming masses outside Europe at bay. That's no recipe for the future. Europe's past its peak and it's going down the other side. Now, America, you can make a better case for, I think, in the 21st century. It has values which it believes in passionately. It has a sense of mission. It has the power, overwhelming power, to support that mission. And it's certainly willing to provide leadership. And I would say that at the very least it's going to run the first part of the 21st century. But my question would be, does America have the puff to go the long distance? You see, I believe that America's ultimate dream has always been to insulate itself from the rest of the world and the dangers that lurk out there. I think isolationism is always in the background in American thinking. There's also a downside to America's current preeminence, and that is America as a target. We've seen what happened on 9/11. I think the chances of another mortal blow, some massive terrorist attack, a radiological bomb, something like that, they're incalculable, but security experts will tell you that something is bound to happen, and America must be the principal target. I think there are two other constraints on America. One is, rather like Gulliver and the Lilliputians, America is sort of entangled, tied down by carping allies, innumerable imperial burdens, the loss of the historic concept of the West as an alliance, instead of looking at a multipolar world of shifting alliances. Frankly, the world doesn't like tall poppies, and it likes to cut them down to size. And then also, there is the historically inevitable cycle of imperial decline. Great empires and great powers, they rise, and they then fall. In Europe, in its different manifestations, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, the Nazi world order, the Soviet Empire, they testify to that truth. And can America really be so different? Now, my candidate for the country, which was going to emerge as the great magnet of the 21st century, China, of course, has been through the cycle of imperial decline and is now coming out the other end of it. You know, the concept that China will run the 21st century is not very strange if you have any sort of sense of history. After all, most centuries have been Chinese centuries. It's just that we are a bit too parochial in this part of the world to have noticed it. As late as 1820, China was still responsible for over one-third of total world output. It's really just the last 150 years which have been exceptional, when China has not counted for much. And it always reminds me of the old story about the Oxford Senior Common Room debating where to invest college funds and deciding that real estate would be a good investment, and the medieval history don saying, well, that's all right if you just take the last 1,000 years. This is rather the same. Now, the great imperial China, the Middle Kingdom, that died, and Mao Zedong, with his mad obsessions, he drove a stake through the heart of China. But now China has purged itself in every sense, and it's rediscovering itself for the future. Of course it starts the 21st century a long way behind anyone else in terms of wealth per capita, military strength, political freedom, you name it. But do just remember, we're in 2005, we're talking about a century, we're talking 95 years ahead of today, and so you need to look to the future. And you see, while my contention is that Europe and America are probably on a downward path and past their peak, China is indisputably moving upwards and advancing very rapidly. It's determined to improve the living standards of its huge population, determined to end the state of passivity and humiliation of the past, and determined to recapture what it regards as its rightful place in the world. So that makes China single-minded and very dynamic and very disciplined, and that allows it to maximize great resources in its quest for growth and for recognition. Of course, it's not democratic. It's not going to become so for a very long time anyway. But just because you don't like a country's system of government doesn't mean it's not going to be a very powerful influence in the next century. So what would I say are the forces which are going to bring China forward? First, it's going to continue to grow rapidly. Its economy is going to continue to grow rapidly for two or three decades at least, and it will become the world's largest economy within about 25 years. Now, that is actually not a particularly significant statistic, because its wealth per head of population will still be relatively low, even with that. But nonetheless, I do notice that Europe, and I think Mark does in his book, rather boasts that it's the world's largest economy and the world's biggest exporter. And if China exceeds it, as it will do within 40 years or so, I think we can't deny the relevance of that measure. What's sauce for the European goose is sauce for the Peking duck, one might say. Also, China has a sense of mission. It's got this mission to avenge its past humiliations and reclaim what it regards as its rightful place in world affairs. And that's a very powerful driver of national behavior. China's not actually, and never has been, an expansionist power. And it certainly doesn't aspire to convert the world to communism. It's given it up at home. So it's not going to try and convert anyone else. But Chinese nationalism is a very, very strong force. And I think we've all seen in history the extraordinary paths, both positive and negative, I admit, but the extraordinary paths to which nationalism can drive countries. Then look also at China's hinterland, the economically powerful 60 or 70 million overseas Chinese, the countries of Northeast and Southeast Asia, all growing rapidly, the developing regional organizations, ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, APEC, which I can never remember what it stands for, but it includes virtually everyone around the Pacific. And in these, China is becoming ever more a leading factor. And it's just rather like, if you're watching rugby on television, there's a line out. The tallest man jumps for the ball, pushed up by those around him. I think China will be pushed up by the rest of Asia. And add to that the extremely interesting development between India and China, which after several decades of hostility are now trading with each other to an unprecedented degree, developing a political relationship. And when you think that those two countries between them represent now over two-fifths of the world's population, you have to believe that between them they will exert great influence. My last point is about soft power, which Mark made a point of too in the case of Europe. Don't underestimate China's soft power. Of course, it's very different from Europe's. But the Chinese model has many attractions, and the Chinese are doing a much more skillful job now than they ever have in the past of selling that model in Latin America and in Africa and in parts of Asia. The idea of not being too worried about democracy, but instead of concentrating on growing national wealth and prosperity, combining it with a strong sense of nationalism, that model has attractions. So I would be less than honest if I said I thought China was bound to be the dominant power in the 21st century, but I do believe that Asia, led by China, will be the area which will make its mark most of all on the 21st century, and I'll rest my case with that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, three very stimulating contributions there. Let's have some questions and short points. We'll take them up to about 5 to 2, and then we'll have a summary. Right at the back at the top.
Hello, thank you. I just wanted to ask you a last question on the Chinese model. I don't really understand in what sense is it different, this growth without democracy, from what the United States are trying to do in Iraq at the moment. Thank you.
Next, over there.
William Horsley from BBC. Perhaps I could put to the panel the point that a successful model or country or power has to have a single focus, a White House, a Rome, or whatever. And surely what we're seeing now in Europe, I mean, only today we're seeing the most huge bust up over what the future of European economic policy is, with all pulling in different directions. We saw the same over Ukraine and many, many foreign policy issues, Iraq and so on. Despite all good intentions and many wealth and many good things about the European Union, surely we must accept that it has no central brain and therefore it's doomed as a power.
Down here, gentleman on the left.
Mr. Bobbitt, if I understood right, connected the existence of the European Union to the division of Europe and the Cold War. Now, may I offer an alternative explanation about the raison d'etre of the European Union, which was mainly to make sure that what Lord Powell called the mess created in the last century does not happen again. To put it plainly, the raison d'etre of the European Union was to make the wars impossible in Europe.
Okay. Linda.
Thank you. I just wonder if it makes sense at all to talk about who is going to lead 21st century, because as Lord Powell said, Europeans are parochial until rather recently, and Chinese were very parochial until quite recently. And perhaps it's the history was, the world was always multipolar. It just depends on how you look at it.
Over there, yes.
Yeah, you know, it's just a very quick comment about the Chinese case and how this they can have this economic growth even without democracy, and if it can be a kind of model. Well, all the estimations about economic growth in China say that they will grow. They will still grow at these rates, but only if they reform not only their legal but also their financial system. So the thing is that I can agree with the Chinese case, but I will add that comment that only if they democratize their system.
Why don't we take some of these points about China to Charles, first of all, and then I'll ask the other two panelists to comment, and then we'll try and do another round of points.
Well, first of all, to the gentleman upstairs who said that he couldn't see much difference between the Chinese promoting prosperity without democracy and what America was doing in Iraq, I'm afraid I just totally disagree. If you, sir, didn't think that the elections in Iraq meant anything, then I'm very sorry for you. I thought it was a remarkable demonstration of people's desire to vote and have a say in their lives, that 60% of the Iraqis turned out to vote. That is actually more people in proportion to the population that turn out to vote in Britain. When I talk about the Chinese model, what I was trying to say is that the Chinese, I think, have a special appeal to quite a number of countries in Africa, Latin America, and even the Middle East. They're saying, don't worry about the West's agenda. Don't worry about all this democracy and freedom stuff. You've been pushed around by the West for far too long. Look at us. We've done it by ourselves. We have our own model. We've put building the economy first, building up our national strength. Model yourselves on us. Join with us. Together we can make a resistance to America and to Europe have become, over time, a more powerful force. That, I believe, is the strategy. It's soft power because it's not based on military power, really. China's military power is relatively inadequate. I mean, China's military budget is, the highest interpretation, $30 billion a year. America's is $420 billion. So I don't think you can say China's much of a threat military to anyone. But in terms of soft power, it is. On the comment about China as a model needing a legal and financial system, don't underestimate how rapidly China is moving in this direction. I find that most British companies now believe they can get a fair hearing in a commercial court in China or in an arbitration procedure. Not, I would agree, in criminal courts or other wider civil actions. The real problem at the moment is not so much getting a fair judgment in China as getting that judgment implemented in practice. And I made this point to the Chinese Prime Minister not all that long ago, and he listened very carefully, and he said, well, tell me about it. We have just the same problem for Chinese companies. I mean, it's very difficult to get judgments implemented in China. But things are becoming more sophisticated all the time, particularly in the financial system, particularly in regulation. And I think you would find 10 years from now that China's not a long way behind Europe or America in terms of financial regulation and regulatory models generally. It'll still be behind in terms of the quality of justice, but not nearly so far as it is at present. The best thing they could do is stop making judges wear uniforms. I think that would all look a bit more independent. As for the question, does it make any sense to be discussing this at all because we're all so parochial? Well, I'm not sure that's true. I think it would have been true 100 years ago had we had this debate in 1905. I suspect most people would have thought the British Empire was going to determine the 20th century. Because, frankly, people taking part in this debate wouldn't have looked much outside that concept. I think people do look more widely nowadays. I think whether you call it the globalizing world or whatever, but with television and all that, people are aware of what's going on in the world. So I think you can have this sort of debate and try and look forward. Of course, all sorts of things we can't foresee now will happen. But on the balance of probabilities, I would say that Asia has a better chance of being the most influential part of the world over the century taken as a whole than any other part of it.
Philippe, do you want to express a view on the comments so far?
Well, I think probably only two of them were directed towards what I said. The remark about the European Union, I certainly agree that the greatest motive behind the European Union was to prevent another war in Central Europe. My point really was that enterprise couldn't have succeeded without attention to the security side of the dimension. Well, I'd also add, if you want to look at motives, that there were many motives behind the European Union, and I think one of them was to consolidate the security initiatives in Western Europe. The other point, I guess, I would think is the first question that was made. What is the difference between Iraq and China? That kind of question, I'm just sort of crestfallen. I don't really know what to say. In 113 days, over 100 million people voted in states that had never held elections. Now, that may all fail. In fact, I think it probably likely will fail. It's so ambitious an agenda. But to say that it means nothing, that it can't be distinguished from a state that has never had free elections and still doesn't and has no prospect of even entertaining the constitutional idea, just leaves me without much to say. If Harold Wilson came to Washington once and he really upset the White House press corps. He was having a press conference and one of the reporters said, Mr. Prime Minister, I listened to your explanation, but I didn't understand this point. And he elaborated his question. And Wilson said, yes, I see you didn't understand that. And I feel sort of in that position. I just don't know what to say.
Mark?
I'll start with William Horsley's question. Do you need a single brain to run a century? I think actually, as I said in my remarks at the beginning, that actually the most exciting thing about the European Union is that it doesn't have a single brain. And actually that kind of relates a bit to the question about how the century is going to work as well. Because personally, I don't think that anyone's any one country or force is going to run the 21st century. I think the 21st century is going to be the century of democracy, where individuals will run their own lives. And the beauty of the European Union is that you don't have to make a major trade-off between personal freedom, between your national identity, and being able not to be bossed around on the globe and oppressed by countries that are bigger than you. Because through the sheer bulk of the European Union, you can talk as an equal to any superpower when it comes to Roger's boss talking to the US or Japan or China. We do it from a position of strength because we've come together. But it doesn't make us any less British or any less French or German taking part in this enterprise. And that's what I mean by that Europe will run the 21st century. That will become a wider model, that we won't see that the only way that you can not be oppressed on the global stage is to create bigger and bigger nation states, which was the lesson of the 19th century when Italy and Germany and other states were formed, because the principalities that made them up were not big enough to stand on their own two feet and were worried about being invaded by others. The European Union shows that that's no longer necessary, and that's sort of why I don't fully disagree with, in fact, I don't disagree with anything that Charles Powell was saying about China. I think the big question is what happens to China as it grows. I think there is a battle for China's future, which is emerging there. It has a lot of soft power at the moment, largely in undemocratic countries that want to have the sort of autarkic existence that Philip Bobbitt was talking about in his remarks earlier. But it's an unknown question what happens to China as it becomes richer. It's certainly not going to be a bigger kind of Britain. It's going to be very Chinese and will be completely unrecognisable in some ways. But in terms of how its politics are organised, what kind of role it plays as a global power, I think it might look quite European. I'm very struck when I go to China how similar it is to the European Union, both because it hasn't traditionally been interested in the rest of the world. It's a regional power rather than a global power. It's totally traumatised by its past and doesn't want to go back there. It's not interested in a free economy and consumption at the expense of social welfare and equality, and it wants a kind of balanced economy. And it is also increasingly becoming a multilateral player that is interested in the United Nations, that's interested in building a neighbourhood club. It's got a very different idea of sovereignty from most European countries, so it doesn't believe in pooling it at the moment. But it could end up being caught up by the logic of it, of the choices it's made, in the same way that other kind of nationalistic countries that were scared of pooling sovereignty, like Britain, have been over the course of time. And our attitude towards these things have changed. And I think that, for me, that China is the most likely force that will deliver a European century, not only because of what it will do itself, but because its very emergence will also cause others to look at how they want the world to be run. And I think certainly if you're sitting in Washington at the moment, the idea of separating law from strategy in the way that Philip Bobbitt warns against might be a realistic prospect at the moment, while the US is so much more powerful than any other individual country. But as the century moves on and other countries move out, then the idea of having a rule-based world order of these sort of neighbourhood clubs might become a lot more attractive. So maybe China's emergence will also cause the US and others to adopt these European principles.
Right, I'm going to call another couple of people. Great numbers. just if I can just throw a point in from the chair. Of course, we like the idea of Europe being something. I actually would like Europe to be able to do something as well. And that's what I spend a lot of my time actually hoping that we might actually get to a stage where this thing might actually be able to work effectively to address, in terms of doing things, some of the problems that nation states can no longer effectively address on their own. And I wonder what you think of the prospects of that. Anyway, point up there. On the front row. Yeah.
My question is, what do you think is the importance of the historical legacy that almost all the world, apart from East Asia, was once the European colony, that laws and institutions are built in the European model, that the elite has been educated in Europe, and so on. Again, apart from East Asia, which is quite interesting, almost all the rest of the world, what is the importance of that?
Lay it down there.
And today there's the first poll in France saying that 51% of the French people actually against are likely to vote no at a referendum. So just wanted to have your thought on that.
Gentleman at the back, sir.
It's a question for Mr. Leonard. It's just taking up on the kind of triumphalism and exceptionalism of Europe we've got going on. In an introduction of your book, I'll paraphrase, you say that most Americans see Europe's belief in international institutions and the rule of international law as weak and unworldly, something they can no longer afford. I mean, there's a lot of American scholars that will probably argue that, but particularly the most recent Gallup poll is still saying that 6 in 10 Americans still say the United Nations play a necessary role in world affairs, and they wanted to at least play a major role in international policy matters. If that is the case, in your most recent book, British Public Diplomacy, you're commenting that without a clear sense of the Americans' perspective and the assumptions under which they are operating, these differences in worldview could lead to suspicions of bad faith, claims of hypocrisy, and worse. If it is this, rather than any difference in values between the quarrelling parties, that can turn a division, which is apparently amenable to rational dialogue, into something that seems irreconcilable. Would you accept what seems to be your own criticism of yourself?
Now, I'm just going to take two more. Lady there and gentleman up there. Lady. Yeah.
Thank you. I just said an Asian, I could agree with Lord Chow that, you know, Asia could be sort of in the 21st century, and led by China or not is another question which we are yet to see. But then, even though if Asia going to be leading, would you think that the European Union, would be still the very influential factors, even for Asian? Because only if European Union model work out, then Asia can be kind of uniting themselves somehow to, you know, kind of being in prosperous. And also, what do you think if, like, what Asia would have to learn from European Union in terms of overcome their nationalism and overcome a lot of factors that European Union is facing at the moment? Thank you.
And final point up there.
Yes, I also want to respond to the Chinese model. I think about Chinese model, not just only economic development without democracy. They also without any independence of the judicial system. They also has no liberalization of the media. So how can we think about this model that can be very successful in the future without, economic development without democracy, without elections, as well as without liberalization of the media, without freedom of the information, as well as without independence of the judicial system? Or you thinking about the China can overcome these difficulties under the authoritarian control forever? Thank you.
Philip, do you want to comment first? And
No.
Well, I'm not sure I can remember all these questions, but just running through them very, very quickly. You, Roger, would like to see Europe do something. Well, yes, but one has to remember, militarily, Europe can't do anything unless it can use the Americans as a taxi service to get themselves there. They don't have any transport planes. And secondly, I mean, Europe does tend to do the wrong thing. Look at all the money it pumped into Mr. Arafat, who has been one of the main obstacles in Middle East peace. Now that he's gone, there is now a serious prospect of it. So Europe does need to sort of think ahead a bit, not just do the easy, politically correct thing. Secondly, East Asia, not having British institutions, but East Asia does have British institutions, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Singapore, to name but three. And I think a lot of British-type institutions do shape thinking in East Asia. Should Asia follow the European model of building a sort of European Union? Well, I profoundly hope not. I think Asia is going a more sensible way. I think they are going the way of cooperation between governments through the institutions I mentioned, ASEAN and APEC, working together, but not trying to merge their sovereignty and their differences and build a single institution with a sort of Brussels, which no doubt have to be in Singapore, right at the heart of it. Can the Chinese model without a free press, a free judiciary, and so on, is a perfectly fair point for now. But we're talking 95 years ahead. And I think that just as South Korea and Taiwan and Singapore liberalized their economies first, and then 20 years or 25 years down the road liberalized their politics and are now pretty good democracies, I think China will go that same route. And I'm always burned by the fact that as late as 1989, Margaret Thatcher, for whom I worked for so long, didn't believe that she would see the end of the Soviet Union or communism in the Soviet Union in her lifetime, and within 14 months it was gone. I think you should never underestimate the speed with which things in life can change. Maybe my last point would be this, and it perhaps comes a bit from my business background. I think when we are looking at who may dominate or run or whatever the right word is in the 21st century, branding is important. I think Asia, and particularly China, is developing a brand, and I think it's a powerful brand. America's had a brand for a long time. You could say America's built on brands. I don't feel that Europe is developing a brand, or not one that's persuading many people outside Europe. And indeed, as somebody reminded us, with 51% of French people saying they're against the Constitution, not necessarily developing a brand within Europe either. Thank you.
We thank Philip for joining us. He's got to leave, and Mark to sum up.
Okay, well, I'll be brief. First, to Roger, will Europe be able to do anything? I mean, I think it will be able to do things, and when it does, they can be very significant. But I think what Europe is will be more important than what it does. However, there are things one can do to make it work better, and a European constitution is one of the things that will help it be more effective, to try and bring together the different strands of Europe's presence in the world, trade and aid, as well as its foreign policy and its growing military and security policies. And I think when they are brought together, they can have a very positive impact, as we've seen recently in Turkey, where by trying to align these different things together, we've brought about an extraordinary revolution
in Turkish politics. The challenge really is whether we can have any impact on countries that aren't going to be members of the European Union. That, I think, is not something that is impossible, but it is something which will require a lot of discipline and some slightly different structures. And I think that's why the European Constitution is an important way of trying to bring some of these structures up to date and make them work better. The reason I don't talk about it so much in the book is because I think what is significant about the referendum on the European Constitution is that it's a referendum on above all on what's been achieved over the last 50 years, and that's really what the book is about. It's a it's a peon to the very quiet, undramatic, unsexy developments of the last 50 years, which have had this profound impact on the world. But if you look at any of the individual things that have led us to where we are now, on its own it seems trivial and very unexciting and boring. Together they have had a profound impact, not just on our continent, but I think will have a profound impact on the world. And I think the European Constitution is part of that. And I think if we reject it, we're willfully destroying what has been achieved in the past, rather than necessarily whereas a vote in favour is obviously not a great leap forward, but it is simply about consolidating and making what we already have work better. In terms of the sort of triumphalism US-EU point, I mean, I don't think that there are any fundamental unbridgeable differences in perspective between the European Union and the US. I would sort of I agree very strongly with what Philip Bobbitt was saying earlier, that none of this would be happening were it not for the United States of America. In many ways, the European Union was an American revolution in sovereignty, which took place over here. It would not have happened without the American nuclear umbrella. It would not have happened without the Marshall Plan. It would not have happened without the encouragement of successive US presidents. But now it has happened, and it is extraordinary, and we need to look forward. And I hope that the future American presidents will take a bit of the revolution which they had in Europe back home and start returning to their earlier policies of creating multilateral institutions, supporting them, and seeing the international rule of law as a way of entrenching liberal democratic values rather than a constraint on American power. But I do think there will be differences in perspective, obviously, because most European countries are small and middle-ranking countries, and they're less able to get their way through traditional means of power, whereas the US will continue, certainly in my lifetime, to be the biggest and the wealthiest and the most powerful, one of the most powerful countries in the world, even if China does catch up with it. So that's, I suppose, where I want to end. But thank you very much. I'd particularly like to thank all the organisations that sponsored this as well, who made Lunchtime possible, and Roger for chairing it so effectively.
I was going to say, we're only 3 minutes late, which isn't bad. Mm-hmm. Thank you again to Blackwell's and the Fabian Society. You can buy Mark's book, I hope, outside, alongside a rather little provocative pamphlet I've written, if you're interested as well, on this subject. It's been a very good occasion, and let's give a big hand to Mark for making it possible.